with someone when they have that revelation, like, why are you praised?
It's making sure
that maybe looking at this case, it could be an interesting process piece.
Okay.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Today we take it for granted that entertainers can speak out and advocate for all kinds of causes, political and otherwise. That certainly wasn't always the case, though, and one of the pioneers there was Harry Belafonte. Belafonte, with that honeyed voice, had a long string of hits. The Banana Boat Song, Jump in the Line, Jamaica Farewell, as well as a career as a leading man in the movies.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the sun shines daily on the mountain top, I took a trip on a sailing ship, and when I reached Jamaica, I made a stop. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way, won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
But Belafonte has been for quite a long time a leader in social justice movements. He was a confidant of Martin Luther King during the civil rights movement, and he worked with Nelson Mandela in South Africa to bring down apartheid. And even though he's now 90 years old, he's still active. One of Belafonte's fans is certainly Jelani Cobb, who writes a lot about civil rights issues and politics for The New Yorker.
This is his office.
Jelani went to visit Belafonte at his office in Midtown Manhattan, and this was about a year ago when Belafonte and his team were working out the details of an upcoming festival.
So Mr. Belafonte's office is like an archive.
Hey, how are you?
You know, when you walk in, there are his gold records that are on the wall, and then there are posters from some of his films, and you kind of walk through his biography by looking at what's on the walls. When we got there, we talked for a moment with his daughter. She's really heavily involved in working out the logistical details for the festival.
Now it's just a matter of, pushing our ticket sales and having bodies on the ground.
We were waiting for Mr. Belafonte to arrive. And some people walk into a room and some people make an entrance.
Sir, Mr. Belafonte.
Let me rush through this verbiage to just express my regrets.
And at 89 years old, Harry Belafonte still makes an entrance. I jokingly told him that a friend of mine, when I mentioned that I was going to be talking to him, I asked her if there's anything that I should ask him for her. And she said, yes, ask him if I can have his phone number. And this is someone who was in her 30s. he now walks with a cane, and he's thinner than he has been, in earlier points of his life. But there's still something really very dignified about him. Sir, it's good to see you.
I got to tell you something. I've discovered it's nice to see anybody.
with Belafonte, it's like picking up an encyclopedia and flipping through the pages. There's so much information there, and there's so much lived experience. Like the fact that he owned a burger joint in the Village at some point in his career when he was convinced that he wouldn't make it as an actor.
Yeah. Didn't own it long because he went bankrupt. I didn't charge enough for the hamburgers. And most of the people who came to eat in the restaurant were all my friends, acting students, who also broke and didn't, and said, I'll pay you when I get from my next gig. Well, I got a drawer full of next gigs, no money.
But when you talk to him, he kind of grounds his sense of identity in everything he is. And being the child of two very hardworking but nonetheless disadvantaged West Indian immigrants.
As a young person watching my mother go through the indignities of poverty, she came home too often broken, a broken person. Mm-hmm. She stood in line down onto the L on 3rd Avenue to get day work.
And this is in Harlem?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something you said that was really interesting, I thought, which is that you said people think of you as an artist who became an activist, but you think of yourself as an activist who became an artist.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
Mm-hmm.
when people say, when did you become an activist? I just said, well, I don't know how you can ask citizens of color who are born into poverty, mm-hmm. when did you become an activist? Mm-hmm. You really become an activist the day you're born, because your whole lust and thrust and effort is to get out of poverty, and that requires a lot of work.
One of the more notable things, I think, was the story he told about going to Mississippi with Sidney Poitier to bring $100,000 to civil rights activists there. Sidney Poitier is, of course, the great African-American actor and Harry Belafonte's oldest friend.
I called Sidney Poitier, which I'd been in the habit of doing, for us to go for fun and games. Mm-hmm. So he thought this was that kind of call. So when I called him, he said, and I said, I got to go down to Greenwood, Mississippi. And there was this long pause. Belafonte, what are you going to Greenwood, Mississippi for? And I spelt it out.
And so, on the face of it, it sounds absurd. These are two of the most recognizable figures in Hollywood, in American culture at this point. And they are trying to organize a clandestine trip to Mississippi to funnel money to a civil rights organization that can't get it any other way.
When we got to Greenwood, it was one of the darkest nights I've ever remembered mm-hmm. seeing. No electricity at all in this little dirt airport. And just at that moment, in a circle mm-hmm. around the airfield, these lights went up. And in the distance, there were cars. And I was with a guy named Willie Blue. I had said to Sidney, I think those are the feds. And Willie Blue said, feds my ass. That's the Klan.
Wow.
I looked at Sidney, and he was not in a humorous mood.
It's just really kind of amazing story and kind of the dynamics between the two of them and driving around in the middle of the night and being concerned that the Klan is going to come get them. And it's funny, but it's also poignant. And at 89 years old, it's very easy to just talk about life in the past tense. But I think the other reason why I wanted to talk to Mr. Belafonte was the fact that he is so deeply enmeshed in things that are contemporary and current. He's not talking about things that happened in 1966. Except as a means of shedding light on what happens in 2016. Have you been surprised or dismayed by anything that's happened in our current politics that makes this moment particularly important?
Yes. What really stuns me is the absence of black presence in the face of the kind of animus that's being heaped upon us mm-hmm. to gerrymander voting districts, to change the voting zones, to close down privileges that are given to workers mm-hmm. who Sundays and weekends to be able to vote. This uh-huh. onslaught is all about race mm-hmm. and there is no real substantial voice coming out of the black movement. Our organizations are fallow. Where is SNCC? Where is SCLC? The NAACP? It is the absence of black consciousness and a black response to these things that I think that has ennobled people, like emboldened them, like
Well, Black Lives Matter, I presume.
Well, Black Lives Matter is something we created. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking the Donald Trumps of the world.
Uh-huh.
Where's the black voice? Mm-hmm. Where's the black Congress? Where are the committees? Not individuals, but where's the collective? We don't have a labor movement like we had when we did the March on Washington, because labor movement, by and large, belly-upped. There is no labor movement in this country. There's a labor struggle, mm-hmm. but there's no labor movement. Mm. We have no peace movement.
What do you see the difference between those two things, a labor struggle and a labor movement?
A movement, I think, is an organized body with purpose, mm-hmm. with declared targets, with clarity of philosophy, with an ideology. A struggle is when somebody slaps you and you try to cover yourself from the blow. Mm. There's no underbelly. There's no grit. There's no challenge. And we certainly don't have the political leadership. It's not in the White House. It's not in the Congress. I kind of welcome this.
Mr. Belafonte was trying to orient himself, I think, in time and in a kind of activist space. He began talking about what he saw as the failures of organizations that were led by his contemporaries and that they left a void that had to be filled by other groups. And I think he was implying that the rise of things like Black Lives Matter was as a result of, you know, I think it's probably not too harsh to say, other people dropping the baton.
There is no voice that stands strong in leading some mighty response, some righteous response to what's going on.
I think it's important to recognize also the reverence that a lot of younger people have with for Belafonte. You know, John Legend certainly is one of those people, and then, you know, various voices and elements of Black Lives Matter that have been in dialogue with him. And there is a cadre of younger artistic and activist people who see in Belafonte kind of a mentor figure, kind of one of the last vital links to the civil rights movement that much of this work is still inspired by. And I'm not sure there's anyone else who quite occupies that niche.
When I listen to young people like Jesse Williams, when I listen to John Legend step in and speak out, I feel rewarded that somewhere along the line, these are the dividends for what we invested. All my colleagues who are now dead and gone, because I now understand that I'm officially at the end. I don't want to do it anymore.
It was jarring to see him talk about the fact that we all have a finite amount of time here, and he's thinking very much about what it is that he's done.
I am going to spend the rest of my days perhaps being more radical than I ever thought I would ever be, saying things that are more radical, because I no longer want to lead anything or be part. I just want to say the truth and what it is. There's a lot of stuff to be said. Where I go with it, I don't know, but I'll be knocking at your door.
I'm always eager to talk to you, Mr. Belafonte. Okay.
Sounds of laughter everywhere, and the dancing girls swaying to and fro. I must declare my heart is there, though I've been from Maine to Mexico. But I'm sad to say I'm on my way. Won't be back for many a day. My heart is down, my head is turning around. I had to leave a little girl in Kingston Town.
Harry Belafonte talking with The New Yorker's Jelani Cobb. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. I'm David Remnick. Welcome back to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks so much for tuning in. John Lee Anderson is one of the most incredibly intrepid people you could ever meet. He's reported on war zones and four continents for The New Yorker and other publications. And he acquired his comfort with travel very early. His father was a diplomat and Peace Corps official, and John Lee was raised in half a dozen countries. When he was a young man, long before he went into journalism, he took himself to a remote part of the Amazon jungle in Peru, journeying up the river called Madre de Dios.
I had an unusual upbringing. I had an inordinate admiration for people who were able to do things with their hands, to hunt, to live off the land. And from a quite young age, 11, 12, I had been trying to do it. My parents had tried to facilitate it where they could. So I spent a year in Africa when I was 13. And I'd spent a year on the Mosquito Coast, 17 and 18, living and working as a machetero, as a peasant, earning a dollar a day with Garifuna people on the coast of Honduras, and learning how to climb coconut trees and use a machete and to fish in a dugout canoe. And I had a great admiration for people that knew the forest, knew the wilderness, and could survive in it. I felt like I was a city boy wanting to learn the original secrets of life. It's funny because I realize as I'm talking about this that this is the stuff of, you know, adventure tourism and even television shows now. And it just wasn't then. I first went to the Madre de Dios when I was 20 years old. So it was in the late 70s, with an idea to go upriver to where, you know, in those days we still talked about wild Indians. And I was pretty gauche, and I thought that would be, it was something I'd always wanted to see. I wanted to see the original world. I was young. I was not yet a journalist. I had had a couple of years at college and left to go to South America to explore. So I hired a man to take me upriver into what was called the Manu Forest. It had recently been declared a national park. It's part of the river head of the Amazon in the corner of Peru, neighboring Brazil and Bolivia. It's a vast region, a kind of an amazing biosphere that is also home to some of the world's most isolated people. And I camped on a sandbar near an Amaricaire indigenous village. I'd been told that they were unfriendly and they weren't hostile, but they didn't meet my eye. You know, I knew that they were not happy at seeing me there. I now realize that what I was seeing was a community that had been devastated in the previous half century. The Amaricaire had been one of the great warrior tribes of the region. By the time I went there, there were about 500 left. I wanted to go further up. This was still the main river. I wanted to go off into the tributaries. It was like getting off from a highway onto a trail, really. And we did. We went up the Manu River, which is then into the national park. I forget whether it was our first or second night up the river, but you know, these are long days in the canoe. And there were suddenly two men on the shore. I remember them as incredibly strong, fit men. One in particular, I'll never forget, he had this black hair. It was like a mop on his head, and it was cut ragged around his shoulders. And they were standing over a dead peccary, a wild boar. And my boatman hesitated, but we stopped. We hadn't had meat. In the end, we had a meal with these two men who were, for me, of an unknown tribe, and we had no means of communication. And they just stared at me all the time. And at one point, I remember looking across at this one man who particularly fascinated me because he was so strong looking. He'd cut off pieces, and we were eating them. And he had the actual bone, the actual shank, and was holding it with his feet. And with his arms, he was chewing off the rest. And I thought to myself, this is a glimpse of ancient man. There we were. That was it. I returned to the Madre de Dios this time because of the mysterious appearance over the last several years of the Mashcopiro Indians. For almost 100 years, they remained in the forest. And, you know, there were occasional appearances, but it wasn't until the last 4 or 5 years that the Mashco had been repeatedly coming out. Even adventure tourists had begun to see these people who would appear on the riverbank. In some cases, they would be threatening. In other cases, they would be just staring at them. There was an incident in going back to 2011 where they killed a man. In the years since then, there had been more and more sightings of them. And then suddenly, this last year, they killed, with a bow and arrow, a young man in a village of Machigenga Indians. Now, the extraordinary thing is, as I say, that for about 80 to 100 years, the Mashko had disappeared into the forest. Now, suddenly, they're coming out. So anthropologists and others, the zeitgeist is full of papers and findings and debates about what's going on. Why are these people coming out? You know, they're now prey to drug traffickers, to men seeking hardwood timber, which is worth, you know, hundreds of thousands a single tree, and so on, gold, diamonds. The speculation was that the Mashko were coming out in distress, that they were coming out because they can no longer survive inside. There was a kind of growing consensus and an alarm spreading that perhaps, you know, it is the end time for these people. So the Mashko coming out forced the government to address the situation. So that meant that the government, through its culture ministry and its recently created Office of Isolated and Uncontacted Indigenous Peoples, staffed by a handful, literally a handful of young anthropologists with almost no budget whatsoever, now we're forced to consider making contact with the Mashko to find out what the problem was, why they were attacking, why they were coming out. And so they began last summer to make what they called expeditions of controlled contact. They have an outpost on the river, and through native interpreters from the Jine tribe, who are basically cousins of the Mashko, they've convinced them to make their appearances there. The outpost is up a high bluff, and there's a longhouse there with a water tank and a generator. And they have a bench on the edge of the bluff, and they spend their days looking across to see if there's any appearance by the Mashko. The first time I saw them, I saw a mass of naked people standing against the white scree of rock of the far riverbank. This was maybe the fifth or sixth they had had in such encounter. When the scouts and the anthropologists arrived on land, they were immediately besieged by the group in a friendly way, because they knew them now, particularly by the children who climbed on them. They were inspecting them. They searched their bodies. I noticed that one of the scouts, one of the Jine women working with the anthropologist, is named Nelly. She's quite a chubby woman. And I noticed that the women were sort of kneading her breasts. And then Rommel, the sort of lead Jine scout interpreter, we watched as the children sort of made him run with them and do races. Anyway, there was all of this milling around. There was a lot of playing. You could see that they were also making faces to one another. Usually this would be the children with Rommel. The adults would come up and watch this. And then sometimes they would join in too. And I could see the anthropologist asking questions. Back at the camp, back at the post, I asked Nelly what was going on.
Yo vi que te estaban revisando.
And then she said, well, they saw how fat I was. And they said, you're pregnant. And I said, no, I'm not pregnant. I'm just fat. They didn't know what that was. And one of the women said, well, I am. And she squeezed her breasts and squirted her breast milk in Nelly's face.
Así, las chicas lo hicieron así.
No les has visto, estaban ahí con sus tetas.
No me digas.
It was this kind of haphazardness. But they had begun to get pretty much register who was who. They knew who the leader was, and he was there that day. I immediately recognized him. A young man, about 22, tall, called Kamotolo. And they talk a lot about Kamatolo. They say that Kamatolo seems to understand that the outside world is right there, that it has certain benefits. He'd always expressed a lot of interest in their canoe. He would often go and sit in it. Two things that had emerged. The Mashko did not swim and could not fish. They had no canoes. They lived in the forest. So this is very unusual. But so far, they'd been frustrated in discovering why they were coming out. The team, you know, they worried about the fact that they weren't in full control of this idea of a kind of pure contact. The lead anthropologist, who was Luis Felipe Torres, a young guy, was full of sort of self-doubt about whether or not this was a good thing, but he didn't know what else to do. It had fallen upon them to look after these people. So, you know, here you have had a young, you know, progressive Peruvian from the city who'd learned anthropology, but felt a moral quandary about whether what they were doing was ultimately right. They were having to respond to them because they had killed someone, because there was a clamor from the communities where these people had been killed that these people needed to be reined in. After this visit, for the first time I saw the kind of fragility of their existence there and their vulnerability to the outside world, because there was a doctor who was part of the group as well, and he was really concerned because he said two of the women had coughs. And he began to work on a kind of an emergency plan in case they had begun succumbing to flu. And he told me there was a 3-day rule with indigenous communities. I asked him what he meant by that. He said they begin dying within 3 days. The children in particular begin to die just like that. They drop like flies within 3 days. And he said he knew that eventually there would be an epidemic and it would be devastating to the Mashko. So they agreed to come back again. We'd been waiting for them. It was the day they were supposed to come, and they didn't show, they didn't show, they didn't show. And then finally, I heard this excited roar, and there they were. But this time it was different. This time, only 3 men appeared. Kamatolo, another, and a boy. And the older man walked sideways to the edge of the forest to a group of bushes, and he kind of hid himself there. The anthropologist was really worried, and he said, you know, this doesn't look good to me. They might be planning an attack. Where are the women? And he explained to me that in the history of these encounters, this kind of controlled contact thing, that in the past 40 years there have been 60 scouts killed by indigenous peoples, and usually the attacks occur at this stage in the contact. As they were getting ready to go in the boat, the women appeared and the children. What I felt I saw on this trip was a glimpse of the original world as it's ending. People are no longer metropolitan, you know, urban Americans, Peruvians, everywhere, are losing primary experience. We're no longer having direct contact with the original world. Where I was, it's still there. The very original world, before all of our history, before Columbus, before Christ, before all of that stuff, how we were when it was just us and nature, it's disappearing, and it probably will disappear, if not in our lifetimes, in our children's lifetime. It's going. The Mashko Pito are coming out of the jungle. There's only 100 isolated groups left in the world. 70 of them live in this area of Peru and Brazil. This is it. This is the end. This is the end. That's an extraordinary thing.
staff writer John Lee Anderson. You can find his article about the emergence of the Mashko Piru at newyorkerradio.org.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Jessica Henderson and Sarah Sandbach. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.